Well, first, the return to profit for Fonterra. It's released its annual results in the past half hour. It's a big turnaround from last year's loss of $605 million. It has announced a full-year profit of $659 million. Fonterra Chief Executive Miles Hurrell says 2019-20 was a good year for the co-op, with profit up after tax by more than $1 billion, debt down by more than $1 billion, and a strong milk price. The dairy cooperative has confirmed the final milk payout to farmers for the season just ended at $7.14 a kilo of milk solids, which is in line with its forecast, with a further dividend of 5 cents a share. The profit, excluding the gains from asset sales and other one-off costs, is $382 million. With us to discuss is NZX analyst Julia Jones and Massey University Professor of Agribusiness Hamish Gow. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Hamish. Julia, could we work through these numbers with you first? A return to profit, what does the result tell us about the health of one of our biggest companies?
So, I mean, to turn around such a big profit, we've got, you know, $659 million profit. What it shows is that there's been a really good focus on getting the business side of business right. So getting the, I guess, the simple things right within the business, getting focus back. So they've got a core focus, and I really do believe that they've created a lot better connection in with New Zealand. So they've got great touch out in market, but they've connected much better, far better, back in with New Zealand.
What are some of the standout figures in here for you?
Oh, look, I mean, $1.1 billion debt reduction is a big thing. You know, being able to hold that milk, farm gate milk price at $7.14. $7.14 is another big thing. You know, it actually increases in revenue, growth, profit, all these things that they've brought through that they've just made such a significant difference in. But yeah, definitely that debt reduction, which means that they've and look, people will have different views on this, right? But it means that they've consolidated, they've focused, and it gives them a great foundation to move forward.
The normalised earnings per share, their significance, this is a measure of values per share, is it not?
Yes, it is, yeah.
And is that healthy?
Look, I mean, it depends. It's always a tough one with your cooperatives, right? Because what happens is a big part of it is the income goes directly back as the farm gate milk price. So dividends traditionally have been a little bit lower. But look, if we think about Fonterra, it is a good result for them, given what we've seen last year.
Can we work through some of the factors in that? First, the milk price itself. Has it been pretty robust compared to where things were at a couple of years back?
Yeah, well, if you look at I think a 10-year average is approximately about 705, I think. And so, you know, to be working above that is a really a positive thing. It has been quite robust, and it's probably been quite stable. Look, it's very easy for me to say I'm not a dairy farmer and I'm not paying bills, but realistically, when we look at where we'd have, you know, that big 3-year drop, you know, around, I think it was 2008, 2009, 2010, where they had really low payouts. This shows the consistency of their payout over the last 2 years is a demonstration of a consistency of business practice, of focus and consolidation.
What parts of the business have done well out of the release this morning?
Well, look, I mean, obviously the food service business has had difficulties for, you know, COVID, restaurants shut down. That was a booming side of it. The high-value ingredients have done well, so they're like the whole milk powder, the butter, the staple ingredients have really held it. And I think, again, it comes back to you can't just focus on one thing. So they didn't have all their eggs in one basket, and they had diversity. So it's really been... Now, people call it commodities. I don't think it's commodities. I think it's high-value ingredients. But it has literally been those staples, the cheese, the butter, and the milk powders.
And again, just referring the in China, they've expanded their anchor food professional product range. Where does this sit in the business?
So it's very much in the retail space,
right?
As well. So so they have actually done quite well in the retail space overseas as well. Obviously, they have some different brands out there, and they've got some really good partnerships which have helped supported this number as well.
It does point out, as you've alluded to there, the impact of COVID on the second half of the result, on the second half of the year.
Yeah. I mean, look, food service literally went from hero to zero. So this was a business that was growing really quickly, And, you know, overnight, and you know, their food service is quite extensive in China, and that was the first country to actually completely lock down and be very strict in that space. So it's anyone's guess how we see that recover. It's been a slow recovery. But what the great thing about what Fonterra could do with a lot of that product was actually channel it back into retail.
And just looking forward to the outlook, anything significant there? It's a quite a broad range it's giving for its forecast milk price.
Yeah, I know it's a hard one. Actually, you know what? We get a lot of hassle ourselves. People need to, you know, I'd love people to know that milk prices are very scientific. So it's not someone kind of putting their finger in the air and hoping they can come up with something. So it all depends on, you know, the auction prices and GDT of what's happening with whole milk powder. It's a whole lot of calculations that go into it. And it will be very much a moving beast until we get sort of a good sort of 80% of the way through the season. But look, I would be shocked probably, and I don't want to sound negative, if it was over seven again for this season at the end of it. But I'd be shocked to see it below six. There you go, there's a pretty useless big range for you.
Thanks very much. Really do appreciate it. NZX Head of Analytics, Julia Jones there. Well, listening in is Bass University Professor of Agribusiness, Hamish Gow. And Hamish, you have been a critic of where Fonterra got itself to under previous leadership and previous strategy. What's your take on this result?
I'm very pleased. I'm pleased for New Zealand. I'm pleased for the dairy farmers out there and the shareholders. And extremely pleased for the board and the senior management who have done a fantastic job turning Fonterra around. And I would agree with Julia in that they've really focused in on their core competencies and really moved themselves well into the high-value ingredients. And it really is a high-value ingredients play along with the food service, although food service has taken a knot with COVID-19, which is out of their control. They really have focused into how to move milk and get the best value out of it for New Zealand farmers.
What's happened in the 2 years since we had the real ructions at the company? It was down to an acting chief executive and a new chair. I recall it dropping its forecast payout, cutting its dividend, holding its shares in order to make those announcements. What had happened at that stage where, you know, even the Shareholders' Council was up and asking some pretty stiff questions of where the company got to?
Well, you have to look at the first thing to start with. There's a new board. And so there's been a massive turnaround in the board, and they've done a fantastic, I would argue, they've done a fantastic job resetting strategy and really working out what works for Fonterra and how they keep it focused, and they can tell a really easy story that everyone can understand through it. Before, Fonterra was really, really complex, and even analysts on the outside couldn't fully understand what they were doing. But now we've got a way better, everyone's got a way better understanding about actually how Fonterra makes money and what its strategy is going forward, and it can be easily communicated to not just the farmers and the investors within Fonterra, but also the external stakeholders, their customers and markets. And that's made a huge difference. And also the employees within it, they know how they need to go and make money. They know how to where they need to focus and where not to focus on.
You had been very critical of what had been a top-heavy corporate structure. It had grown very big. Has that been addressed?
Yes, I think at one level it has been. It's certainly, there's been a large shakeout of people and really focusing in on what really makes money and what doesn't. I think they were playing around the edges and a whole lot of things which you can get into when you've gone through a large period of growth, and this has allowed them to really consolidate down. So they've shed a number of staff. Some people may argue they've shed too many. Other people would say they're probably not enough. So it'll come out as they go through. They're the only ones who really know whether they've got the right balance at the moment. But they're a lot better. They're a lot slimmer organisation today than what they were 2 years ago.
Going back even further, perhaps going back 4 to 5 years, again, when you're a heavy critic, I mean, at one point when they were being hit with a low milk price, at various other matters, you were questioning the resilience of their underlying financial position. Is it a far better position today?
I think they're in a way better position today. They've reduced debt and they've got way better free cash flows coming through the organisation. So they've obviously slimmed up their organisation substantially and get a way better, cleaner cash flow running through that organisation and being able to gain returns off that. So they're in a substantially better position today than what they were 5 years ago. And that's really obvious. They've got rid of assets that have been underperforming. They've got rid of businesses in areas which are really difficult to manage and underperforming. And so they've got back to what they really have to do, which is help New Zealand farmers shift liquid milk into a processed product and then move it into a market with volume and do that really, really well and create value out of it. That's really this high-value ingredients. And the complementary part to that is the high-value food service space as well, because they're the two places that you can really move volume easily.
This question of moving up the value chain, that it had been too dependent for too long on commodities, we had seen some increasing share in the higher value products, the value add products. Is it where it needs to be? Interesting, just listening to Julia there, it sounds like it's the commodity end that's been a big part of delivering this result.
So high value doesn't necessarily mean that you need to go to the consumer. Because there's a real cost in doing that final last mile to the consumer, and that's quite expensive. And what we find with most of the companies that do that last mile to the consumer, so at Nestlé, they've diversified out of the fixed processing assets, and often they get all their product co-packaged by other people, and they just sit in the R&D space and the consumer space and don't do the stuff in between. What we see with Fonterra now is they've recognised that they can provide really, really high quality ingredients into that manufacturing and branded products with their partners there, and let the partners take the final market risks. But they become a really trusted partner in that process and get high value because they're doing all the ingredients innovation and capturing greater return on that part of it. And then they're doing the same type of thing, what I seem to see in the food service space. So they're stepping one back from the customer, but they're working with trusted partners in each of those different places. And I think they're creating a substantial amount of value relative to the risk that they get if they took one more step beyond that.
How much of this can fairly directly be tracked back to a change of leadership? 18 months, I think Miles Hurrell's been in his job. And the board leadership as well. How much of this is clearly a new or refined strategy?
I think you could almost put most of it on those two changes, which is a change in leadership at the executive level and a change in leadership at the board level. And I think it's that combination between them which have really been able to allow them to be able to focus and drive this new strategy forward and really get that going all the way through the organisation. Now, there's probably other things which they need to change, but man, this is a fantastic result for New Zealand, and hats off for this group for doing such a good turnaround in basically a couple of years.
Are we still too exposed market-wise, very heavily exposed to China? On the one hand, particularly at times like this, you see the value of the agricultural underpinnings of much of our economy. People always need food, they always need the basics. But are they still too exposed to a too small a number of markets, do we think?
Well, New Zealand's exposed to markets anyway. New Zealand's the only developed country in the world that's got that our economy is based off primary industries and we're not co-located with our primary market. So we rely on international markets for us selling all of our products overseas. We've got effectively no domestic market. Australia has a substantial domestic market, and so they balance each other out into internationals. Everywhere else, it's the domestic market that dominates. And so New Zealand's in this unique position in playing into these international markets and understanding how to play those markets. We have to focus. We can't spread ourselves over everything. Otherwise, we're going to be a commodity player. And so we've got to choose markets where we've got strong relationships and we've got strong integration. And what's been interesting over COVID-19, particularly with China and a number of our Asian markets, is we've been the trusted party to be able to deliver a product into those markets. And so as opposed to us being knocked back, we've actually probably seen a strengthening of our relationship with those markets as the market players, with as our partners in those markets have come back to New Zealand and said, can we get product to keep on feeding us? Can you ship us in product to go through? And so we've seen I would argue we've seen a strengthening of a number of those markets. They still, having all your eggs in one basket still puts us at risk, but our strong trading relationships have really held us through COVID-19.
On the question of the agriculture sector, the primary sector generally, its role even in yesterday's GDP figures, which were obviously a bloodbath, but it was one of the sectors that is holding the line. How can you speak to its significance over both the immediate sort of survival period economically that the globe is going through and also any recovery?
So, this is my personal opinion, I think what we've got is, as it's always been the case in New Zealand, every time we go into a recession, it's Prime Ministries and regional New Zealand that carries New Zealand through these types of economic challenges. Because there's demand out there and people still have to be fed, and we're one of those stable countries that can keep on delivering into those international markets, and we've got companies like Fonterra who can deliver based on their relationships with key players. And so you just keep on, we're the steady ship that runs in there all the time. And everyone will pull back and there'll be pullback, but they'll want to keep those strong relationships, which will allow that agriculture and primary industry sector to balance New Zealand out. Relative to what we see when people start closing their pockets in urban New Zealand, so particularly in Auckland, we're seeing a contraction there. But if you go to a town like Whanganui, they've seen sales go up. There's the economics of the region are going up at the moment because of agribusiness. And they've seen twice as many tourists in Whanganui than what they saw last year. And so there's large differences between what we're seeing in regional New Zealand and what we're seeing in urban New Zealand. And it's going to be regional New Zealand and primary industries, I would argue, that's going to hold us through this next period. That's not sitting there saying that we're not going to have, everyone's going to feel some pain, but we're going to see a fairly buoyant regional New Zealand relative to what we see in the urban parts of New Zealand.
Could you speak just finally, Hamish, to the question of labour, though, and labour shortages? With the unemployment rates heading where it's heading, are we in a position to move more New Zealand resident citizens here now into the labour needs in the agriculture sector, or are we going to hit a big labour shortage if we can't have migrant labour coming in? Is there a chance to rebalance that, and how would it happen?
That's a really good question. I'll answer it in reverse. If we don't get the labour for the horticultural sector, we've got a real train wreck on our hands. Can we move unemployed labour from Auckland to the regions? Potentially. However, what you do is you break down your family unit and you break down all your support networks that they have. And New Zealanders traditionally aren't necessarily a very mobile groups, particularly the groups of people who have been affected by the types of challenges we've got at the moment. And so I'm not sure that it's going to be easy for us to be able to move unemployed office workers out of Auckland and get them to go and work 10-hour days in the Hawke's Bay or Central Otago.
What about tourism, though? Or is tourism itself being very dependent on migrant labour? Are they competing potentially over the same labour source?
Potentially they are. It's going to be an interesting question because I think the tourist industry is going to be based on probably a student workforce coming in and engaging to support the tourist part of it's going to be fairly constrained in sort of December and January when everyone's on vacation, and that's the same alignment with students from universities, etc., and high schools. So you've got a population that you can use for that one. The horticultural sector comes into challenges because their harvest season runs all the way through and doesn't end until May with the last of the kiwi fruit. And so how do we hold that across that larger period of time?
Really interesting times. Thanks very much. Hamish Gower is Professor of Agribusiness at Massey University.